Okay, so the Court of Appeals is now back in session on this June 17th, 2021 calendar. The second argument on our calendar this morning is Erica Ann Cortez on behalf of a minor versus Francisco Frederick Galvan. And the case number is A201503. This morning, we will be hearing oral argument from counsel for appellant only. Respondent did not file a response in this case. Counsel, before you begin your argument, I would just ask you to please identify yourself and the party you're appearing on behalf. You will have 15 minutes to present your argument. And whenever you're ready, you may begin. You could see the clock on the screen. Is that right, Mr. Sherman?
I can, Your Honor. Thank
All right, so that clock will count you down. You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Eric Sherman with the law firm of Dorsey & Whitney LLP and the Tubman Safety Project. Appearing today on behalf of the appellant, Erica Ann Cortez, and her minor children, JJG and FCL. This case raises a narrow and apparently novel question of statutory interpretation under Subdivision 6A of the Domestic Abuse Act. That subdivision prescribes four independently sufficient factual predicates for the issuance of an extended or subsequent order for protection. The first of these is that, and I quote, the respondent has violated a prior or existing order for protection, end quote. And that's at paragraph B, subparagraph one of Subdivision 6A. In the district court below, appellant established this factual predicate. As the district court expressly found in paragraph 12 of its findings of fact, which can be found at page 3 of our appendix. This finding of the district courts was based upon respondent having been convicted of two separate gross misdemeanor violations of a prior OFP in force between the parties. Based in part on this finding, the district court entered a subsequent order for protection in favor of petitioner herself and her minor daughter, JAG. The district court held, however, that respondents' violations of the prior OFP were an insufficient statutory predicate to support a subsequent order for protection in favor of JJG and FCL, even though they had been protected by the prior order. This was because, in the district court's view, the respondents' violations were not sufficiently in relation to JJG and FCL. In relation to are three words that are nowhere to be found in Subdivision 6A of the Domestic Abuse Act. The language of that subparagraph does not require an applicant to show that a respondent violated a prior or existing order for protection in relation to any particular person. The applicant must show the respondent's violation of a prior or existing OFP, and that's all. For the court to require a showing that a violation of a prior or existing OFP occurred in relation to the particular applicant would mean adding words to Subdivision 6A that just aren't there. And under settled principles of statutory interpretation, that's something that a court simply cannot do. By requiring
Mr. Sherman, what about the case of Schmidt v. Coons? You have cited it on page 5 of your brief with respect to the standard of review. I think it also has bearing on the merits of the argument that you have presented. Are you familiar with that case, and can you speak to its relevance to your argument?
I am, Your Honor. As I understand the holding of Schmidt, it is that to obtain an initial order for protection, a petitioner must establish that that petitioner is a victim of domestic abuse. Subsequent to Schmidt was decided the Rue case, which is also cited in our brief. And the Rue case, in the Rue case, the holding was that existence of domestic abuse does not need to be shown for a subsequent or extended OFP because it has already been shown in the initial order for protection. And the petitioner has thus established that person's standing as a victim entitled to relief if they can make, I should say extended or subsequent relief, if they can make the one of the four factual showings required under subdivision 6A. Rue, of course, was also a case out of the Minnesota Supreme Court. And I think the way in which it distinguished Schmidt in that case is equally applicable here.
Well, so, I mean, let's just for the moment take Schmidt by itself. I mean, the reasoning of the Supreme Court in Schmidt, it seems to me, is that the purpose of the act is to protect victims. And so an OFP should not be issued to protect a particular person unless they have that person has been a victim of domestic abuse. And you're right that in that case arose from the initial issuance of an OFP. In the course of discussion, the Supreme Court made reference to extensions, the 6A, paragraph 6A, and said this provision expressly allows for the extension of an OFP when a person is a victim of the respondent's domestic abuse. I mean, doesn't that paragraph essentially govern your appeal and essentially require that each person protected by the extended OFP must be a victim?
Your Honor, the way I would answer that is to say that each of the applicants in this case established their victim status already in obtaining the initial OFP in 2016, and that they need not do that again under the holding in rule. They need only establish to obtain subsequent or extended relief to establish one of the factual predicates contained in subdivision 6A. And then that enables the court in its discretion to fashion subsequent or extended relief.
Isn't one of the other distinctions between this case and the Schmidt case the fact that the petitioner in this case actually herself was a victim of domestic abuse, unlike in the Schmidt case where the petitioner was not and the minor son was not?
Your Honor, I think that is certainly a distinguishing factor of Schmidt from this case. I still would urge the court to look at Rue, which I think has already dealt with the question as to whether once an applicant has established victim status under the Act, whether they need to do that again. I mean, clearly, the intent of the legislature in enacting subdivision 6A was to set a lower bar for persons who have already had an OFP in effect. And I think there were, any number of rational reasons the legislature could have been thinking of when it fashioned subdivision 6A, including evidence that, domestic abuse is cyclical, that sometimes OFPs are fashioned in such a way with certain premises or radiuses around premises being placed off limits that a violation of the OFP by the respondent might be ambiguous as to who the victim is, and that simply that the respondent's lack of respect for the court and its order justifies extended or subsequent relief for everyone who was a party to that order.
So, Mr. Sherman, I've read Rue, and I did not think it significantly affected this case. I set it to the side. My recollection is Rue did not overrule Schmidt, did not limit it, I don't think. It simply said that it the requirements of Schmidt did not apply in the case of an extension, which is essentially that there need not be another finding of domestic abuse. If one of the requirements in 6A is satisfied. Do you disagree with what I said, or what am I missing from Rue?
Well, I don't necessarily disagree with your recitation of the facts, Your Honor. I think the legislature has made no distinction between subsequent relief, and extended relief. And in the absence of some distinction between those two types of relief having been made by the legislature, I don't think that's something that this court can or should supply by judicial decision.
But isn't that what the Supreme Court did in Schmidt? I mean, the Schmidt court acknowledged that that there was no language in, I'm looking at it now, if there's no language in the statute as to whether a court may grant an OFP only for victims of domestic abuse or whether non-victims may also be granted an OFP. But in that silence, the Supreme Court essentially said, as a matter of case law, that given the purpose of the act, an OFP should be issued only to protect a victim of domestic abuse.
Well, I mean, certainly Schmidt addressed, and looking at and trying to synthesize, I think, various subdivisions and features of the act, you know, determined that the gateway, if you will, for obtaining an initial order for protection against a respondent includes showing that you are a victim of domestic abuse or one of the other sufficient statutory grounds, but that you are the target of domestic abuse. But once having made that showing, I think it's equally clear that the intent of the legislature was to not to make the victim's job in proving the need for extended or subsequent relief as burdensome as was the initial showing.
So if, let's say we agree with you that Schmidt does not forbid what the district court, excuse me, let's say we agree with you that Schmidt does not require what the district court did in this case. Could the district court's decision be justified as an exercise of discretion? In other words, the district court, when extending, may choose to consider whether it's necessary to protect somebody who was once a victim, but during the previous 2-year period has not been a victim while this OFP was in a place, and therefore there's a lesser need to protect that person going forward. Why would that not be within a district court's discretion?
Well, Your Honor, I think I do have to concede that relief under the Domestic Abuse Act is always discretionary. The error that the court, that the district court made in this case was not to recognize that it had the discretion to grant relief. It foreclosed that analysis by holding that appellant had not met the statutory predicate. Once the statutory predicate is met, the relief, the extent of the relief, the duration of the relief, are all matters of discretion for the district court. And of course, the district court would have to make findings sufficient for review by this court to show that its determination was consistent with the facts adduced in evidence and logical. And this court would review that grant or denial of relief under the abuse of discretion standard. I think if the district court had not made a pure error of law, it's quite a different case.
Well, how do we know whether the district court was deciding that issue in paragraph 14? Well, how do we know whether its reasoning in paragraph 14 reflects a legal analysis or a discretionary analysis?
Well, Your Honor, I think the words that Judge Byrne used in the paragraph, I believe it's 13 at page 3 of our appendix, petitioner is also required to meet the burden of proof that it is more likely than not that the allegations in the petition are not only true, but rise to the statutory requirement for a subsequent order for protection. I don't think that leaves much ambiguity about what Judge Burns was holding there. He was saying that—
Well, Mr. Sherman, if we can't tell whether he was exercising his discretion or applying the law, what's the remedy?
Well, Your Honor, I think if the district court hasn't made a sufficient record for review, The answer to that is reversal and remand to the district court to make findings that that the court may review for an abuse of discretion. By requiring petitioner to establish a violation of the prior OFP as an express condition of obtaining a subsequent OFP in favor of JJG and FCL, the district court established a statutory evidentiary threshold that the Domestic Abuse Act does not prescribe. That was a legal error and an abuse of discretion, and respectfully, the case should be reversed and remanded for further consideration of JJG and FCL's application under the appropriate standard. Unless the court has any questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you for your argument today. And that concludes our oral calendar as well. The court will now recess to consider its non-oral calendar.